Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, October 15th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. Well, last night, Game 3 of the National League Championship Series, the Dodgers and Braves, and you remember what happened in Game 2. The Braves had a big lead. The Dodgers came back and scored 7 runs in the last 4 innings. We talked to Dave Roberts before Game 3, and he said flatly, he said, yeah, I think it's going to bleed over into Game 3. In other words, all that offense they put up, the excitement, the hope that they felt at the end of Game 2, he thought was going to carry over. Man, was he right from the top of the first inning.
First offering, and Seager rips one into the gap in left center. Over there to try and cut it off is Riley, and he falls down. Betts racing for third on his way to the plate, and he's in. 2 pitches into the game, 2 hits, and the Dodgers lead it 1-0.
Yeah, so they jumped on Kyle Wright early, and man, they kept the pressure on.
3-1 now, the pitch. Swing and a ball hammered center field. Coming on is Pache. Picks it up on a bounce in to score is Seager. Racing for second is Smith, and he's in there. Will Smith runs pretty well, and he hustled, got himself a double, and the Dodgers lead it 2-0.
And the Dodgers rally continued.
The pitch. Swing and a ball hammered center field. Pache on the move. Turning and looking, and it's gone into the bullpen and out of here. Jock Peterson hits a homer to left center. He didn't miss that one, and the Dodgers unloading. It is 5-0 in the first.
And the Dodgers inning continued.
Seager swings here, laces one to center. That'll touch down for a hit. Pache up with it. Racing in to score is Taylor. To third is Betts, and it's 7-0. Seager with 2 hits in the inning.
Boog Shambi doing yeoman's work on ESPN Radio. He was on the call last night with Jessica Mendoza, who we're going to talk to in a little while, and myself. The Dodgers loaded the bases. Still the top of the first inning.
3-2, 2 outs. Here's the pitch. Swing, and Muncy crushes it. That one out to right center field. That one way back there. Look out. Gone. It's a grand slam, and it is all Dodgers. L.A. absolutely unloading in the first. Muncy will touch them all with the sacks pack. 11-0 in the first inning.
And that was a record. The 11 runs in the first topped 10-run innings amassed by 4 other teams in postseason history. The 2019 St. Louis Cardinals, the 2002 Angels, the 1968 Detroit Tigers, and the 1929 Philadelphia Athletics, who were managed by Connie Mack. Well, after the Dodgers took that early lead, both teams began to pull regulars. It became like a spring training game. But Cody Bellinger and Corey Seager stayed in the game.
Here's a pitch. Swing and a ball hammered. Right field. That one on its way. Back there. Gone. Bellinger will touch them all. It's a dozen. 12-0. For Bellinger, his second homer of these playoffs. Next pitch, swing and a high fly ball, right field, way back there. Home run! Say it with me. He's a triple shy of the cycle. It's 13-0.
And the final score would be 15-3. And after the game, Dave Roberts was asked about his thoughts in the blowout.
You know, obviously, the infield hit by Mookie started us off, and then Corey going the other way. And I just realized that we got all those runs with 2 outs, you know, just really good at bats. I mean, really, Alana, just good at bats. And then we hit some homers and took some walks. Just a really, obviously, a well-played inning. And I do think that last night's ninth bled over into tonight. So it was just obviously a fun offensive night for us. Played good defense. And even, you know, when the game was out of hand, we still, I thought, in my opinion, took really good at-bats. Julio wasn't sharp early, but for him to get through 5 innings to save some other arms, I thought was huge. So a good night for us.
He was asked about the identity of his Game 4 starter today.
Yeah, we're going to start Clayton tomorrow.
So it's official. Clayton Kershaw, who's been dealing with some back spasms, scratched from his Game 2 start, he will start Game 4 later today. Max Muncy talked about his grand slam in the first inning.
It's pretty cool. You know, there's not too many things that are cooler than that, but the biggest thing to me is our team got a W and got us back on track.
Game four, Rays against the Astros, the Rays with a chance to close out the series and clinch a trip to the World Series. And we've all seen what Jose Altuve has been going through with his defensive issues. Well, at the plate, he's not having any problems. Top of the first inning.
The 1-0, a fastball swung on, hits a deep left field, a Rosarena back, it's gone. Another home run for Jose Altuve. His third of the series, and the Astros lead 1-0.
Altuve's next plate appearance occurred in the bottom of the third inning.
1-1 and a curveball that he sends towards the right field corner. It's well hit and off the base of the fence. Meadows plays it off the wall. Maldonado in to score. Stopping at third is Brantley on an RBI double by Altuve, and the Astros lead 2-0.
You know, there's no question who the best offensive player has been during the course of this postseason, and he manifested again in the top of the fourth inning for the Rays.
The 3-1 on the way, and a curveball drill down the left field line. It is gone. A hanging curveball on a 3-1 pitch, and Randy Arozarena has done it again. A line drive, two-run homer, and the Rays have tied the game.
Arozarena has been just amazing in this postseason. But the Astros, with their backs against the wall, fought back in the bottom of the fifth.
And the 2-1 and a fastball clubbed to left field. Springer turns on it. It is deep and it is gone. A rocket down the left field line into the top porch of the Western Metal Supply Company building. A big time home run for George Springer, and the Astros have a 4-2 lead.
And they carry that lead into the top of the sixth inning. And look, with the way that teams manage these days, is typically they will look to pull a starting pitcher after he's faced a lineup two times through. Zach Greinke had faced the Rays two times through, and in the sixth inning, it looked like he might come out of the game. Dusty Baker went to the mound, but he stuck with him, and this is what happened.
3-2 on the way, swing and a miss, he got him. Greinke with an enormous out for the Astros as he strikes out Brasso, and the Rays will leave the bases loaded.
So this is what it sounded like at the end of the game with Houston leading 4-3.
Presley has his sign. Eyes Adames, and again the 1-2, and a swing and a fly ball to right field, but it's going to stay in the yard. Springer, shy of the track, makes the catch, and the Astros win it, and they live to see another day.
The great Dan Shulman on ESPN Radio. After the game, Houston manager Dusty Baker was asked about his decision to leave Greinke in the game.
Usually don't change my mind, but I hadn't had my mind really, really made up until I got out there and I saw, you know, the look in Zach's eyes.
He was asked if he felt comfortable with the move.
I can't lie to you. There were some prayers involved in there on the way back to the dugout. You know, he was approaching that 90-plus mark. I mean, the hottest hitter in the playoffs. I don't know. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
Zach Greinke was asked if he was shocked Baker left him in the sixth.
Yeah. I was surprised for sure.
And he was asked about that mound visit.
Yeah, it was pretty intense, I thought. Since I guess someone else told you. Yeah, Maldi said that I was looking good and that I could get out of it. And, like I said, I thought it was nice having some guys have confidence in you. So that was good. And knew it was an important time of the game. Not that that was do like the end of it right there, but you knew it was pretty important, and it was a tough part of their lineup having to face too. So it worked out. Like, I mean, if it didn't work, then things would be different, but it worked out and it felt good all the way around.
Astros second baseman Jose Altuve was asked about his night.
Well, I didn't have a choice. You know, it was today or go home, and I didn't want to go home. I turned the page pretty quick and show up today ready to help my team.
Now, before we get to Jake Odorizzi and Jess Mendoza, check out the latest episode of Fantasy Focus Football. Field, Matthew and Daniel discuss the Jets releasing Le'Veon Bell, recap Tuesday night football, look ahead to Thursday night football, and talk rankings for week 6. Download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football wherever you get your podcast, and watch it live weekdays at 10 a.m. streaming on Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, and the ESPN app.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, Their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Jessica Mendoza is the analyst for the National League Championship Series on ESPN Radio, Dodgers versus Braves. And Jess, you and I and Boog had that game last night. We'll get to that in a second. I still think I need to recover. And you probably do too as well, yes?
I feel like I'm hungover. Like literally like someone punched me in the face or something like happened. Like I woke up this morning and I was like, wow, that was a rough night.
Yeah, it was a crazy game, a record-setting game with that 11 runs in the first. But let's talk about the Rays and the Astros first. Last night, Jose Altuve hits a home run in his first plate appearance. He hits a run-scoring double in his second plate appearance. What do you think watching that?
Yeah, it just shows you so much about, I don't want to say the character, because it's not the character. It's more of just what Jose Altuve was able to put behind him, because the shots and images of him during the game yesterday, post game yesterday, and then this, even before the game, post game before the night before, and then coming into the game, I mean, Dusty Baker had his arm around him. There were times you could just see that there was so much frustration. You talked about it in our game about how personal he takes the mistakes that he makes. And if he feels like he lost a game for a team, it takes him a while to really get over that. So for him to come in and have the night he had with his bat, to see, honestly, his teammates' reaction, just knowing how much he cares, just because you care for a human being, it was really cool to see.
Yeah, and you know, we talked a little bit on air last night about, and we talked in the podcast yesterday about Altuve and the yips, and you know, I saw some reaction on social media where people are like, okay, it's good he put it behind him, and I was shaking my head and go, like these are two separate things. When I covered Chuck Knoblauch going through his issues, while he had the yips and his career defensively was disintegrating, he continued to be an elite offensive player. So I still think, and I'm sure he totally understands this, that is still a work in progress. What's your sense?
Yeah, I mean, I've played with players that have had the yips, and yes, to your point, like dominate. I mean, Tasha Watley was our shortstop on the Olympic team, and she hit 400. But got to a point late in her career where she was a shortstop. She couldn't throw the ball to first base. And I mean, literally she got to where the first base was by like three hopping it, would literally just throw it into the ground and give the first baseman basically a ground ball to get it over there. And it was a really frustrating. She ended up becoming RDH. She was the fastest player on her team, but it didn't matter. But to your point, it's two very separate issues. My thing with Jose is the fact that you're still able, because what you do see is usually when someone's struggling on one end, it affects the other just because of the mental part of it, right? Like you're so frustrated and caught up about your struggles offensively and it carries over into your defense or vice versa. To see Jose Altuve be able to at least separate that and help his team in a dynamic way, as he has been this postseason with the bat, is just good to see.
George Springer gets a big hit last night. He's gotten a ton of big hits in the postseason, which is why, you know, when people talk about his free agency coming up, I see in social media, there'll be fans who'll say, you know, you don't want him on your team because he was part of the cheaters. And I just shake my head and go, no, this is a player whose abilities, whose talent is very much respected around baseball.
I think he is one of the best postseason players I have seen, the way that he can ignite an offense. I mean, and we're talking going back, you know, the last 5 years, the postseasons, you know, and, you know, cheating, not cheating. I mean, what he's showing now, and he, you know, he's a great regular season player. He's a great leadoff hitter. I mean, we can just talk about his talent, but there's something pretty cool, Buster, and you know this better than me, that historically look back on just like guys postseason runs and the amount of home runs that he has hit. And I think, you know, he's hit more home runs at Dodger Stadium than even like most Dodger players in the postseason. I mean, the things that he has done in clutch moments and the at-bats, you just watch him, the way he plays the game, the energy, the emotion. I know that I will look back in this time and think of George Springer as one of the best postseason players we saw in this time period.
All right, let's take a look at our series. Dodgers and Braves playing game four today. Bryce Wilson is going to start for the Braves against Clayton Kershaw for the Dodgers. After that blowout last night, you know, if you're Brian Snitker and you're looking ahead to potentially, you know, a game five, a game six, and a game seven, we saw Kyle Wright really struggle last night to the point that you wonder, you know, how he's going to be moving forward. They've got Max Fried. They've got Ian Anderson. If you're Brian Snitker, how are you arranging your rotation based on what you've seen the Dodgers offense do the last 2 days?
I mean, I really feel like Max Fried is in the conversation for game five that you're talking about. Yes, yeah, short rest. And I know that the game five isn't the game that, you know, gets you to the World Series. But then you would want Anderson because, to your point, Kyle Wright, it's not that he struggled and then let's give him another chance because he's got stuff. Like, it's the mental part of his game that has always been the issue. And to see the body language, Buster, in our game last night, and honestly, to his credit, I mean, 11 runs, I mean, that's like, it's a beating, right, as a pitcher. But to me, that's always been Kyle Wright's biggest hurdle, is how he can get over the mental, the confidence, all of it. He's always had the stuff. I don't believe he gets over it in an amount of time where he's a factor that you can use him even out of the bullpen. Like, it starts to factor in what you can do as your third starter. And so I think being able to use Max Fried and Ian Anderson is a must within this series as you look at game five, game six, and game seven.
I would, you're sitting with the Braves and you've won two of the four games you need to advance to the World Series. I would be confident if I were Brian, I'd say, you know what? I just want to make sure that those two guys, Fried and Anderson, are fully rested when they take them out. And that would mean pitching game six and seven and having the stomach to sit and watch potentially your pitching staff get beat up the next 2 days. No? Disagree?
Well, what if you don't get to game seven? I mean, that's the thing, is once you decide in game, so let's say they lose game four, then you get to game five and you're kind of a bullpen game, whatever, let's just throw this one in. Now, let's say the Dodgers win that game. They're one win away from getting to the World Series. And yeah, you have Ian Anderson left as a bullpen game. Max Fried is on full day's rest to be able to go. I don't know. I push the envelope. That's just my mindset. I don't know Max and Ian well enough, like, to talk to them and understand where they're at on short rest. But seeing Tyler Glass now do it for the Rays last week on 2 days rest, Garrett Cole come out on 3 days rest, and know that you can get to the bullpen earlier if you can get just 3 to 4 innings, which is crazy, by the way, to even think. You know, getting 3 to 4 innings nowadays is like awesome. If you can get me scoreless or at least a lead at that point, I got you from here. So I worry if you start to plan out to game seven, because that's, to me, when you lose this series.
What do you see in the Dodgers hitters?
Relief. You know, they were pressing. And that's something that I noticed so dramatically in Cody Bellinger's face throughout the game that we had in game two until he hit that triple. And it's just the piled on pressure. It's something the Braves don't have to deal with. They've made it to the championship series for the first time as a team. You know, this is, you know, something that it's really just a win for them. The pressure is all on the Dodgers. And when you look at how the pitching for the Dodgers has been, it hasn't been horrible. So it's really, the eyes were on the offense until late in that ninth inning game, or late into the ninth inning in game two, of like, where is this team? And if you look at like the most pressure, I feel like it's Cody Bellinger that everyone turns to, not so much Mookie Betts, because Mookie, he's new to this team. Like, I think he feels some pressure, but really I think it's Cody that has to lead them offensively and get things going. So when he hit that triple, Buster, and he came around second base looking like a madman. I mean, his helmet flew off. He had, and even Dave Roberts told us, just the look on his face was of frustration and anger and all the things that he had felt to not help his team offensively. Came out in one trip around the bases, and from there, relief, which is the first word I used to answer your question, is what I saw yesterday in their faces to finally show what this offense is capable of.
Yeah, and I'm glad I can ask you this question because I didn't play, you know, wasn't an athlete at a high level for sure, and you were. The thing that popped to mind when I watched Cody Bellinger rounding second base and running to third was LeBron James. If you remember early in his career, and believe me, I'm not comparing LeBron James, the basketball player, to Cody Bellinger, the baseball player, where they are, but just as a competitive person who bears the responsibility of being an important player on a team, if you remember, like, LeBron's first years when he'd be in the playoffs, he was criticized immensely for deferring in the big moments. And it was like he was learning how to process all those times. And then at some point, when you watch LeBron in a big playoff game, he began to get angry. Like, he's like, I'm taking over. I'm sick of this stuff. And that's what I thought of when I saw Cody's face. Like, you know what? He's had all these postseason games where he's been striking out. He's got knuckleheads like me analyzing his swing and where he should be. And it was like, that's it. I'm hitting third, and we're moving forward. I'm going to be a different player in these type of moments.
I agree, but I think he needed the triple. Like, I think he needed that one at bat to break him open. The difference, get the ball, and you can just, hey, I'm going to freaking take this to the hoop. Whereas baseball, that's the interesting part, is you're going to continue to fail. You're never going to bat 1,000. So, like, how you handle that and break through with that one hit that just feels like your defining hit, he had it in game two.
All right, Jess, I'll talk to you in a few hours. Zoom call at 4:00.
All right, let's go. Let's try to maybe keep the runs and the time between pitches at a minimum. If you could work on that for me, that'd be great.
Thanks, Jess.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11 ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Jake Odorizzi was a 2019 All-Star with the Minnesota Twins, and he's been joining us on the podcast during the course of this postseason to talk about all things pitching, talk about all things baseball. And Jake, let's start with this. I'm curious how you felt watching Dusty Baker go all old school last night in the Astros and Rays game, trusting his starting pitcher a third time through the order, and Zach Greinke coming through.
How about that? That was refreshing to see, especially when the manager comes out there and you think, all right, well, this is over with. Where's the sign of the bullpen? And then lets him stand there and he's rewarded for doing it. And, you know, that was so, like, storybook of, obviously it's not the ninth inning, but he gets him out. I'm trying to pronounce it without seeing it in front of me. It's very difficult. so he gets him out, and then after he loads the bases, I thought he was done right there. And then it's like, okay, now he gets another chance and boom, here's the punch out to end the inning on a 3-2, just an absolutely beautiful change up down out of the zone. Like that was so awesome to watch. And for Greinke too, especially, like, you know, I think he commented on it after the game of like what it was like to have the feeling of somebody showing confidence in him. And I feel like that's kind of Dusty Baker's MO over the course of his career. Obviously there's been a little bit of a separation between back when he was managing until, you know, this new age of data and all that type of stuff, but man, that was something to watch. That was pretty cool.
So I, you know, I'm sure that as you're watching that play out last night, you're pitching along with Greinke, so to speak. You're sort of in his mindset of what, okay, what's he thinking? What's he going to do? What did you see in him after he gets that essentially pat on the back from Dusty, you know, the go get him?
Just kind of like an absolute precision of what he was trying to do and execute. Like he was executing every pitch from that point on. Not that he wasn't before, but it was like a heightened sense of control. And I think I saw a thing where he went out of those 15 pitches, like 10 of them were changeups and they were like his best pitches of the day. So I think, you know, Zach specifically, you know, more so than other people, knows how to execute a game plan like to a T. So he just almost like that heightened focus, that hyper focus of his, and he executed it exactly how he wanted to and made big pitches when he needed to. And that's a sign of a guy that's a Cy Young winner and a guy that's been elite his entire career. Now with lower velocity, he's still doing it at a very precise high level. And you know, you could see after his, I think he actually smiled coming off the mound. So like that was for Zach. I feel like that's like him throwing his hat and glove, like we saw in another game of that of a different series, you know?
Right. Exactly. And I'm curious about this. I love telling this story about a longtime pitcher who I covered, Jamie Moyer, back with the Orioles in 1995. The Orioles released him. He was 32 years old. And I remember standing there as a beat writer who's a dope, Jake, where I'm listening to him talk about how he and Mike Flanagan, who was you know, part of the Orioles staff at that time, the pitching coach, he said, you know, we've been working on some things and I'm feeling like I got some things, some tools that I'm going to explore and I can work with. And I remember thinking as he was saying that, come on, Jamie, you got this great family, you got these great kids, it's time to go home. It's time to hang him up, because he had like an ERA of 5.5. And all he did was win about 220 games after I had that thought. When he goes on, he pitches into his late 40s. And as I got to know Jamie better in subsequent years, I realized that there was this tremendous competitive arrogance that he had, that he viewed hitters in a sense as big, dumb oxen who were, their aggressiveness was just waiting to be exploited. And it was something that he was always going to be able to use against them, because they would see him throwing 82 mile an hour fastballs and he was going to use that against them. And he did for so long. And I get the feeling that Zach is kind of the same way. If that, does that make sense?
Yeah, I can see that. Obviously, drastically different repertoires of, right, of pitching between the two. But no, I definitely, you know, I think we all see, at least recently, how smart Zach is when it comes to anything baseball, not just pitching in general. But he's always been brutally honest his entire career. And I think that's part of the same mindset, the MO. Like, you don't need to give a respectful answer on a lot of things, especially when it comes to hitters. Like, sometimes you can give hitters too much credit and you talk yourself out of situations as a pitcher. Whereas Zach is just, he's so cerebral in what he does. And he, you see that now. And that, I think this year especially has amplified that about him, just how he approaches everything. Like he was sitting behind the mound on one of his starts in Oakland as they were repairing the mound, just having himself a great time watching him repair the mound. Sitting in the sitting in the stands during the same game, away from everybody out of the dugout, and then going out there and producing and doing exactly what he needs to do on the field. So I think that competitiveness and that drive that he has, it's not only for pitching. I've heard stories in my time in Kansas City of he would always, he was like talking to new draft picks and asking them like what he thought that they could beat him in, and then telling them, no, you couldn't beat me in that. Like, he's just that type of guy. And I think that's the type of guy you want on the mound in that situation, knowing that that situation isn't going to be bigger than anything that he's ever put into his mind before. I think that might've gone into the thought process as well.
When you see the video clips of him telling the catcher what he wants the catcher to call, as someone who's pitched, what goes through your mind watching that?
So I think like when he's doing that, I don't think he's necessarily telling him what he's throwing. I think they have a system of what he's calling. So when he puts up, you know, two or three, I don't necessarily think he's telling them that it's coming as a curveball or a slider or whatever it is. I think there's something that they've worked out, but what it may be is, you know, it looks so simple that he just flashes the two up there and then throws a pitch. But knowing what we know about Zach and everything, like, I'm sure there's something to it where it's whatever the sign was, and then he puts down, you know, some fingers and it changes the number by whatever. And I'm just pure speculating. I have no idea what he's doing when it comes to that. But it's like the wipe system back in the day. It was like, you know, if I wipe up, it's adding, wipe down, subtracting. But that's like, it's a huge conversation because the hitter is like, what is this guy really telling me? He's throwing a curveball. I'm sure there's instances where he flashes a number and it's that number, you know, the pitch reference for that number. And then it really confuses the heck out of guys. So I get a great kick fit when he does it and has some success with it. It's like I said, he's such a unique, he's like a unicorn when it comes to pitching. And I don't know if we'll ever see somebody quite like him, you know, after that point, just from Cy Young dominance early on till he's been doing this at a high level with lesser stuff for a while now. And like, he just gets there continues to be more layers to him as the years go by. And it's fun to watch and see him evolve and do all this sort of thing. He's a special player. It's incredible.
What, you being in the game, what are you feeling and seeing in Jose Altuve? You know, had the tough night two nights ago. You know, the conversation about the yips, and last night comes out with a home run and gets going. What are you seeing in him?
Yeah, I think it's just separating defensive work from offensive work. Like, it's, you know, I think the defensive thing is a thing going on right now. I mean, I think we can all see that and see the hesitancy and just the wherewithal, like when the balls hit to him in particular, it's people are holding their breath right now, but he's able to separate that from his offensive, you know, when he's at the box, he seems to be confident as a hitter. So I guess it's good to compartmentalize what's going on defensively and separating it from not carrying it with you to the plate. And like, I guess getting down on yourself might be the right word. I'm not really, you know, sure when it comes to him. But yeah, I think at least yesterday, you know, or the last couple of days offensively, you know, he's been the same guy. Defensively, it's just been a little bit shaky. So he's done a good job of separating the two and not letting one, you know, defense roll into his offensive production.
All right. I am part of the coverage on ESPN Radio for the National League Championship Series. And in the first inning last night, watching that game, I don't know pitching the way you know pitching, but I'm counting his breaking balls early. And I think out of the first seven, he threw six out of the strike zone. He wasn't able to throw that pitch for a strike. And not only was he not getting strikes, but a lot of them were non-competitive. And I was, you know, said on air, like, boy, that is a red flag for me, especially against a good offensive team like the Dodgers. What did you see early on?
Yeah, just, I mean, two pitches in, it was already 1-0. That's always a tough spot to be in as a pitcher, let alone, you know, and NLCS as a young guy. But I think the Dodgers took a different approach yesterday. They were a lot more aggressive in the zone as opposed to maybe working some counts. And you knew they were going to break out at some point. Obviously, in a historic 11-run first inning, it's a huge breakout that probably people weren't super, you know, expecting. But they weren't going to be, you know, held down, especially, you know, they kind of gained a little momentum the game before, scoring some runs late. So it was a little bit of a carryover, but I just noticed them, like, they weren't missing the balls in the zone. They weren't as patient in the zone. They were attacking. And like you said, anytime as a starting pitcher, if you're not locating your off-speed pitches early on, I think that just gives hitters the advantage of, okay, I need to sit here, look for fastball in the zone because I know this is the pitch that's being or and vice versa. You're not locating with your fastball and you're throwing your off speed, and it's easier for a hitter to focus on what you're doing in the zone as opposed to out of the hand if they see spin and it's been non-competitive, they just take. So there's a comfort level, but especially with a high level offense like that, you know, that's a tough spot to be in as a starting pitcher. And you know what? He almost navigated his way out of it. All that damage happened with two outs, which makes it even more incredible. But I was on MLB Network Radio yesterday with Mike Farron, and I was saying that I thought this game, that game three, was more important for the Braves than it was the Dodgers, which in a, you know, they're down 2-0, which seems crazy to say, but a team like the Dodgers can do that at any point. And if you're the Braves, going up 3-0 would have been a huge accomplishment and giving you a little bit more leeway flexibility. So I thought it was more important for the Braves to win that game than the Dodgers. But now it's, you know, they won and now it's the series again. It's 2-1. And, you know, I think everyone can see the momentum building on the Dodgers side.
And you're right about that first inning, the Braves thought they might have had the third out. Yoan Camargo makes a throw across the infield. Freddie Freeman stretches. The initial call is that the runner's out. They wind up reversing that call, and then the Dodgers set a record in the first inning for runs. I've got to know Kyle Wright a little bit. We went to the same college, and as I watched him walk off the mound last night, I felt terrible for him. You just see it was like he'd been punched in the jaw. You know, to have that moment. If you were his teammate, what would you say to him after an outing like that?
I think you just go, you put your arm around him a little bit, and you just, you know, say, what's the positive take from this? What can you learn from this? What's your thought process right now? Are you, you know, mentally just defeated, or is it something where it's going to drive you? It's going to, you know, you're going to learn from this, because those are the biggest moments where you could take stuff to learn from and to. Hopefully he gets another start. You know, if the Braves, you know, obviously advance, so have another opportunity. But that's the times where you want to get back out there. You just have to go and you just talk with them. You want them to talk. You don't want them to just sit there and be quiet and just stew in their own thoughts, because you can get lost in there pretty quickly, especially as a young guy on a big stage like that. So as a veteran player, you just want to go and have a conversation with them, keep them talking, listen, you know, say what you saw that was good out there, what they, you know, what their thought process was on some things like that, but how they feel. You just want to have conversations, because getting them talking is so much better than just sitting there like feeling sorry for yourself, trying to figure out what the heck just happened right there, and you're just sitting there watching a, you know, a slow train wreck as the inning continues. And it can be pretty daunting for a young player if you don't take the right, or just have the right mental, you know, fortitude to sit there and really analyze it and figure it out. So you, as a veteran guy, you need to be there for younger guys when they're in tough moments like that. And I think that's the most important thing. If you can do that and get them just to talk it out, and then it's an easier closure. You move on from it. And that's that. It's one game. It sucks. We've all been there to one degree or another, and we're all better pitchers for it afterwards.
So when I covered the Orioles in 1996, they were playing at Fenway Park, and the Red Sox had a Red Sox type of day, and they piled up a bunch of runs, and the score was like 15-1 in the fourth inning. And after the game, I was talking with Orioles owner Peter Angelos, and he was furious because he felt like the manager at that time, I think it was Davey Johnson, should have brought in his best relievers to reduce the blowout. You know, because he felt like the players would be demoralized by a one-sided loss. And I said to him, Peter, these guys wiped this off so quickly and so well. And we talked on air last night about how baseball players turn the page better than any other group of athletes. Can you just talk about that after, how the Braves are feeling after a game like that?
Yeah, that's something that's unique to baseball, because there's so many games that you can't get caught up in one and dwell on it for days on end, like a football, basketball, hockey, whatever it may be. Like, there's days off in between, and that's normal for them. For us, it's okay, you're going to be back out there the next day. Let's forget this one. We move forward. But in a game like that, you almost want to treat it as if it's a win. Just come in, you turn music on, you don't sit there and just, you know, it just happened, but you don't need to dwell on it, because it's not going to change. and you have to go back out there and regain the confidence and the from games one and two, because you know they played really well in games one and two, and that's the mindset they need to get back to. So the longer you focus on game three, the more it can affect game four. And in a 7-game series to go to the World Series, like, there's no time to dwell on what just happened. And even if they would have won that, you know, by 15 runs or whatever it may have been, I forgot, you know, just throwing a big number out there, I don't think they dwell on that either. You just have to move on to the next day, because the next day is more important now that that day's over with. So we're pretty resilient when it comes to bad games and flipping the script real quick, but they're definitely going to need to go out there and prove that today. That it's one thing to say it and say that it didn't affect us, but you can tell by the body language the next day, the at-bats that are put together. You know, I just hope, you know, for fan's sake of this series, like, you don't see the Braves trying to press now, just thinking there's, you know, a team coming for them. I wanted to see them play like they did the first two games. And if the Dodgers are at this level, you're going to have a pretty good series the rest of the way out.
So we know what the Dodgers announced about Clayton Kershaw, that he was dealing with back spasms. They back up his start. Dave Roberts telling reporters after last night's game that he will start in game four. Tell me what you're going to be looking for early for signs about whether or not Clayton is right.
I think with a back, the most important thing is execution and control of his pitches. Your arm is pretty well going to be there, but mechanically you might shift a little bit, and that throws off your command. They just go hand in hand. I've dealt with a back issue a couple of years ago, and your body, just like anything, will find a way to do what it needs to do just to produce. But at the same time, you want it to be as close to normal as possible. So I think that's the big thing to look at today, is see how his control is, because his control has been spot on this entire year. So, I think the stuff's going to be there regardless. He's going to be excited. That's his, you know, his home ballpark again, of growing up in Dallas, and there's fans in the stands now. So it's like, man, this is going to be, I have no doubt the energy level is going to be super high, but the control is going to be the thing that I'm going to look at the most. And I don't really know Kersh personally very well. I've heard a lot of things from Rich Hill about him, and, some people in my agency, but knowing what I've heard about him, I expect him to be his normal self going out there today. And he just seems like the guy that's going to overcome whatever he needs to overcome to be a productive winning pitcher. And I don't think he's going to go out there and fall apart by any stretch of the imagination. So I think it's going to be a really exciting game to watch out of him specifically.
All right, Jake. Well, I appreciate you taking the time and helping me understand more about what I'm watching.
I do my best. I could be as full of what as anybody else, but those are just my views and my opinions. We'll see if they actually play out once the games get started. But always enjoy doing this, so I appreciate you having me on.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Thursday coming in. Brian Stone King at Brian Stone King writes in, is it possible the Dodgers already have an under-the-table secret handshake wink deal in place with Cora in the event they don't win the World Series? I don't know about
Brian, interesting thought. And it's funny, because the last couple of days, a couple of people have asked me if Dave Roberts is in trouble. The answer is no. He just signed a contract extension, so I have no doubt that he's going to continue as the manager of the Dodgers, even if they don't win the World Series. And I'll continue to say, so Alex Cora is going to wind up being the manager of the Red Sox.
We got two contract salary questions here. First one from Dave Kropp at Kropp's Corner writes in, the Padres want to sign Tatis Jr. to a long-term extension, and I believe it is in San Diego's best interest to get it done this offseason. I'm going to set the bar at $350.5 million. Do you think he will go over or under that mark?
Yeah, Dave, if he were to sign an extension this offseason, he would be way, way under that mark, by like $200 million.
Oh.
Look, if you look at the precedents that were set, recent precedents, contracts for players before they reach free agency, Mike Trout had a deal with the Angels where it was like $150 million. Alex Bregman got $100 million. Because Tatis Jr. is so far from free agency, he doesn't have the leverage of free agency. So it would be for a lot less money. But I tell you what, in the current circumstance, can you imagine being a player getting an offer, say, for $150 million? How do you turn that down, Taylor?
It seems ridiculous to us, but I'm sure someone in his camp can rationalize a way for him to turn it down. That generally happens.
There you go.
Last one for today, Brian Roll at Brian Baseball 5 writes in, what kind of contract do you think DJ LeMahieu gets in this pandemic depressed free agent market? Where do you see him signing?
Yeah, it was interesting. Last week, Joel Sherman, who does such a great job for the New York Post and for the Major League Baseball Network, sort of mused about what LeMahieu's contract is going to be. And I think the first number he wrote about was like 4 years and $100 million. I saw that. I'm like, no way. DJ is a great player. But with the numbers being rolled way back, I think a deal somewhere in the range of like 4 years and 65, maybe 70 this winter is going to be a great contract. Because I'm telling you, the more that I talk to people, agents, teams, club executives, I think a lot of teams have been hit hard in terms of financial losses, and the numbers are going to roll back.
Wow, that's pretty surprising that you threw that one out there. All right, everyone. Thanks for writing in. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Subscribe to, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcast, and enjoy the games this evening.
That's it for today. My thanks to Jess, to Jake, to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.